Hey, y'all. How's things? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here on the Liberty Radio Network. Noon to two weekdays, Eastern Time. Thanks for listening. Hey, I really mean that. Thanks a lot. You're a good listener. Catherine Hawkins is going to be on the show today. She wrote a thing for Politico magazine. I'm not certain who's the editor of that thing. I'm not that interested. But I have read some good journalism in Politico magazine a few times, I think. And this one's good, too. We're running it as the spotlight on antiwar.com today. It's called The Lies Hidden Inside the Torture Report. The author's name is Catherine Hawkins, and she's going to set us straight about some criminality of some of our elected and appointed officials. Oh, it's going to be just great, I imagine. The lies hidden inside the torture report. And, you know, we got some news along those lines, too. Torture report news. In fact, let me just mention it. The Senate sent copies to all the relevant agencies, like, you know, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and I don't know who else. And they've all refused to read it. They have all refused to even open it. They all just threw them in safes and locked them up. The Department of Justice took the Senate torture report and just, don't anyone look at what's in there or else you might be obligated to enforce the law. So just don't. Amazing. Not that any of them took an oath to faithfully execute the law. Or anything. And then also, and this is kind of a side note, this probably won't come up in the conversation at all, so I'll just mention that Feinstein is still mad about the CIA spying on the Senate and is slamming their acquittal of themselves. The director of the Central Intelligence Agency appointed a panel of people to acquit the Central Intelligence Agency, and they found that they didn't do anything wrong. When what they were doing was spying on their overseers, imagining themselves to be superior to the Senate, to the elected Senate of the United States of America. Well, kind of elected, you know what I mean. The bought and paid for Senate. And look who we're talking about. Dianne Feinstein. Who's not even actually a human being. She's just a front man for a military industrial complex firm. And no, I know, she's a very ambitious politician from going back in San Francisco days. But did you know that her husband's firm just won a $1 billion contract and now has a monopoly on selling, I don't know how many thousands or tens of thousands of American post offices. All the buildings are being sold, and the post offices are going to now rent out other property for more money. And I don't know, I'm sure Dianne Feinstein's cronies will be in on that too. But this guy, her husband's firm, gets to handle the transaction, has no competition. He's got the contract to handle the transaction on the selling of these thousands, whatever the full number is, of post offices into the private market. Stands to make a cool $1 billion. That's what a joke the U.S. Imperial Senate is in the first place. I mean, he's a military, army contractor is where he gets most of his money. But anyway, that's part of his fascist crony business here. Anyway, but so the CIA, they're spying on Feinstein, mad that somehow the Senate staff got their hands on the Panetta report. And the Panetta report is the internal CIA report about, this is what all of our incriminating documents say about us, Mr. Director, just so you know, back when Panetta was the director. And of course, it confirms all the accusations in the report. We're talking about the full 6,000-something page report here, based on 6 million documents. There's 6,000 pages of a real report, 6,300, something like that. We got a 600-page redacted, declassified executive summary. It was all that's been released so far. But anyway, here the CIA lawyer, their head lawyer, referred the Senate staff to the Justice Department to be prosecuted, I guess, for espionage, for getting their hands on the Panetta report, which for all we know was given to them by a CIA whistleblower, put it on their computer, or was just put there by mistake by idiot CIA torturers who failed at covering their own ass, which is probably the most likely explanation. Turn over all the documents. Oops, not that one. That admits that we're lying about everything. Oh, well. So Feinstein's still pissed about that. This is on the highest level of constitutional crisis. This isn't even just the president versus the Senate. This is the president's supposed subordinates over at some department over there in Langley, Virginia. And they think that they're bigger men than Dianne Feinstein, at that time the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who has oversight over them. What oversight did they have over the Senate Intelligence Committee? What authority of any kind does the CIA have over the Senate Intelligence Committee? None at all. The fact that they would even think that they could do that just goes to show you what a dead letter the Constitution is really at this point. The Capitol. You notice on TV now they got a big scaffolding all around the Capitol dome. They got to polish up that dome and make sure all the marble is looking spick and span to try to just, you know, metaphorically refurbish the image of these ancient institutions. I saw a great Frank Zappa quote the other day on Twitter about how politics is just the entertainment division of the military-industrial complex. Yeah, exactly. And Washington, D.C., virtually all of it, is nothing but a ceremonial little marble palace filling theater operation, basically, like security theater at your airport. It's self-government theater when and every once in a while, you see the truth peeking through like this, where the director of Central Intelligence has no problem whatsoever taking on a, 40-year, 30-year senator, chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Who does she think she is? I'll show her, the head of the CIA said. What? Man, yeah. This is not a limited temporary constitutional republic. It's a corrupt, evil empire. Corrupt, but I wasn't going to say corrupt first, and then I remembered to stick corrupt in there, but I'd already put the N on the A. It's a corrupt, evil empire. The blood-soaked kind. The evil kind. Anyway, fun little indicator of that when you see the CIA taking on the Senate like this. And, you know, I hate to take Feinstein's side on anything because she's horrible on everything except torture, pretty much. And though I'm not the biggest fan of democracy or this Constitution for that matter, I still will side with an elected representative of the United States Congress over having her duties infringed upon by the executive department she oversees, no matter what a department it is, but I guess especially if it's the CIA or the Pentagon. Who's the boss of who here? You know, the only reason the generals don't just push the president right out of his chair at gunpoint is tradition, right? You understand that? It's the only thing stopping it is that, well, we just don't do that. But, you know, if we do that, then we do. And if the CIA can take on the Senate, maybe the Pentagon can get rid of the president if they don't like him. Not that they'll ever get a president they dislike that much under this system, but still. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show. Scott Horton Show. So I got to mention this, and it's really too bad. I don't know. So yesterday was, you know, Bring a Muslim to the Capitol Day down in Austin, Texas, the capital where I live. I kind of wanted to go down there, but nah, I had other things to do. And I think all the good stuff happened during the show anyway. But anyway, so what happened was, you know, it's just like any other field trip that any group takes to the Capitol. That's all that was going on there, okay? This happens all day, every day, whatever little interest group comes. And a bunch of these right-wing idiots who live in this parallel universe where all the stupid, wrong things that they believe are true acted like this was some kind of Sharia law coup d'etat over the people and the state of Texas. And all they're really trying to do, these people who are the semi-official out group, is they're trying to belong. They're not trying to take over. They're trying to belong. They're trying to say, we're Americans too. We love Texas too. We love freedom too. We love big granite statues of believing that government is legitimate too. And so we're here to participate in the civic community of the state of Texas where we live. That's all they're saying. They're not trying to take over. And just think about how stupid this is. Muslims are less than 2% of the population of Texas. Okay? And what is it that they do all day, every day, these Muslims? Many of them Arabs, too. What do they do all day? They get up, they make their kids breakfast, they send them off to school, they go and they work their ass off so they can have a nice house with a yard where they can raise their kids in it, just like everybody else. What in the hell is this? And some idiot gets up there and, oh, the false prophet of Muhammad will never, ever conquer Texas. Oh, really? Yeah, also, the zebras of the African savannah aren't never gonna conquer Texas neither, huh? Scott Horton will never conquer Texas. What a brave stand you're taking. And anyway, the sad thing of it is, and I know liberals are stupid too and believe all kinds of stupid things. Everybody is some kind of stupid truther or another trying to prove themselves right about whatever they're wrong about. But damn, right-wingers, the things that you believe. Do you ever look out the window? Huh, I'm looking out my window and there's zero arson fires anywhere. That 2%, measly 2% of the population of Texas, which is no threat to conquer our form of government, is surely enough people to start major arson fires in our cities or forest fires in our forests. They could probably hijack gasoline trucks and crash them into baseball games. They could take AK-47s, which anybody can buy right down there at corner of 290 and I-35, and they could go and shoot up the gun show at the corner of 290 and I-35. But they don't ever do any of these things, and why not? Because it's not their agenda, because you just believe stupid, wrong things that aren't true. Stupid. Yeah, but didn't you hear about the Boston bomb marathon attack? Yeah, but don't things like that make it that much more apparent to you just how isolated these examples are? When the only actual, even pseudo, terrorist attacks in America since September 11th can be counted on one hand? Boston, Fort Hood, Zazi, the failure cab driver from Denver, underpants bomber failure, Times Square bomber failure. That's all of them. Those are the only actual sort of kind of attacks. And they ain't got a damn thing to do with Sharia law, you nitwit. Other than someone forwarded you an email that said that? Is that it? Or is it AM radio? Because I watch Fox News, and even Fox News I don't think would... Nah, I don't know. It might could make you that stupid, but that's really stupid. You ought to be able to just figure these things out for yourself without any additional information. Just how many Muslims are we talking about around here? And how is it that they're presumed to have a plan to somehow, what, eliminate the entire white majority of the American white Christian? And in fact, Christian is black, white, Hispanic, and everything else is like 80-something percent of the American people claim Christian. But when we're talking conservatives, we're talking 99% white people, fearful white people. Well, there are still 200 million of you, okay? So the Muslims that are in North America, if they all read the protocols of the elders of Islam and obeyed their orders to a T of their plan to subject the American population to Sharia law, they could only just fail. It would be ridiculous. That's why they're not trying, because they're not within 1 million miles of that. You'd have to have nothing but Muslim immigrants to America for the next 300 years. And they'd have to have 10 kids each. And all the Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and everyone else would all just have to stop breeding for your right-wing ridiculous fantasies to come true. Can't you just go to the movie theater and watch a horror movie to be afraid like everybody else? Oh, he's got a knife! Woo! Okay, there. I've had my upset for the week. Now I can live my life without being terrified of things that don't exist in time or space at all. Boo-hoo, a couple of Muslims took a field trip to the Texas state capitol. Next thing you know, everybody's throwing acid in each other's face. That's what somebody said to me. Yeah, down with honor killings. What? Oh my God. Anyway, stop being such idiots, you right-wing idiots. You know who's your enemy? The cops. Your local sheriff's department. They're more likely to kill you than anybody else. Okay? No matter how much you love them. That's who's your enemy. The state. Boo-hoo, the damn Muslims. You know what makes me mad about them Muslims? They all seem to have advanced degrees and own their own businesses or make six-figure salaries working for tech firms around here. And I'm jealous. How about that? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back. Sorry, I'm taking notes on this article I haven't read in 3 days. Before my guest Catherine Hawkins is on here in a little while. Trying to make sure I remember all the most important points. And you know what? She makes her point right at the very beginning. Her most important point. Very, very important article. Again, in Politico magazine. The lies hidden inside the torture report. So we'll get back to that in a minute. Now Libya. Man, no, let me save Libya. because I still want to go through this and highlight a couple of things during the break, too. There's a lot here. I hope you heard yesterday or saw on Twitter or somebody told you, you saw the headline on antiwar.com. I know it sounds kind of silly, but yes, it's in the Washington Times. It's actual good journalism, apparently, in the Washington Times. Secret tapes, they've kind of changed their headline. It's in the URL. It's still correct. Hillary Clinton undercut on Libya war by Pentagon. And now it's secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan war. Maybe that's a better headline because that goes for the pro-Republican political angle, which is the best chance we have of this being a real scandal with real publicity. How do you get Republicans to turn on any war, to be against any war? You got to make it all about personal points against Hillary. Okay, good. If that's what it takes to get this true story told, then cool with me. I don't care. I mean, I hate to see Republicans benefit from anything, but boy, that Hillary Clinton. Samantha Power was right about her. She's a monster. No wonder Samantha Power wanted to convince her to be the monster in chief getting us into the Libyan war in 2011. And this is amazing. And, you know, Dennis Kucinich, of course, was good on all this. He's a reader. And he was good on all this at the time. And here they talk about how he tried to intervene and how the Pentagon tried to intervene, how Gaddafi was even willing to step down. But anyway, we get back to that. Make sure you've got this story. Secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan war. This is the most important story about that war we've had in a while, or about the politics of how we got into it anyway. But let me put that off and go to Daniel Larrison here at the American Conservative Magazine. Cotton's dishonest. Sorry, I can't talk good. Cotton's dishonest attack on diplomacy with Iran. And this is Tom Cotton, who is, the young John McCain in the Senate that we're going to be stuck with for a long, long time. He's an Iraq War veteran, and so he gets to say, I'm an Iraq War veteran before everything he says. And he's a horrible hawk. He's like John Bolton or something. He's completely ridiculous, this guy. And Daniel Larrison here just takes him to the woodshed completely. And, I won't go through point by point here. Again, it's at the American Conservative Magazine at Daniel Larrison's blog. But the point is that I wanted to make was no one on the war party's side can talk about the Iranian nuclear program as a threat without lying. Have you ever noticed that? They have to lie. They have to just go with innuendo and implication and would have you believe. It's very rare you can hear them even talk about details at all. But then if they do get as detailed as saying, okay, there's such a thing as the Arak reactor, that's A-R-A-K, but what do we need to know about it? They'll still only tell you a half a truth. Oh, it makes weapons-grade plutonium! And then change the subject again. Okay, it makes very polluted weapons-grade plutonium, and they've already agreed without asking. It was their idea to convert the facility to make it produce even more polluted plutonium. They don't have the ability to separate the pollutants from the good stuff, and the Russians already have the contract to ever take the spent fuel out of that thing, and it's all safeguarded anyway. The moment they diverted an atom of it, the IAEA would know anyway. Their intentions are obvious and not weaponization. So Cotton has to lie. Tom Cotton, Senator. Tom Cotton has to lie. A nuclear-capable Iran is the gravest threat facing America today. Daniel Larrison says, oh man, if that's true, then great. The U.S. is more secure than anyone thought since it's not a threat at all. Of course, it's not. It wouldn't even be a threat to Israel anyway. Unless you take the imperial definition of a threat, which is someone who has the ability, a state that has the ability, or anyone, has the ability to maintain independence from the empire in any sense. That's a threat. Like Hezbollah. Hezbollah has no offensive capability. They can lob a couple of missiles, but they cannot invade Israel. But they can prevent Israel from invading Lebanon, like they did in the summer of 2006. they kicked the Israelis' asses and drove them right back out of there. So that makes them a threat. See how that works? Same thing for Iran. And, you know, if you read between the lines of what Tom Cotton is saying and what Benjamin Netanyahu and the rest of them say, that's their whole point. That for Iran to have a nuclear program at all is tantamount to them having nuclear weapons and is absolutely unacceptable. But then they don't ever acknowledge that they know that there is no way to make the Iranian government abandon their nuclear program entirely, short of killing them all. And in order to do that, you would have to invade them with a million-man army. Now, Tom Cotton's not willing to tell you that, and I don't know whether he's willing to go and fight for Persia, like he was willing to go and serve the Iranians in their war against Saddam Hussein that he fought so proudly in, leading the Badr Brigade and Mahdi Army legions against the civilian Sunnis of Baghdad, helping get a million people killed in a sectarian civil war because that was what Ariel Sharon and the Ayatollah Khamenei wanted? Oh, and Osama bin Laden? Yeah, what a hero Tom Cotton is. Boy, does he have a lot of gravitas. Well, don't you know? He fought in the Iraq War serving Osama, the Ayatollah, and Ariel Sharon all at the same time. He served everybody but America. Oh, and the new caliph, Ibrahim, as well. Could have never done it without you, Tom Cotton. Trying to tell us that we ought to be taking Al-Qaeda's side, I guess, against Iran now, huh? And all over a fake nuclear weapons program that never existed, that never was a weapons program, and is not a threat to the United States or Israel in any way. And we got right to it with Sahimi on the show yesterday, but then we had to go. But the point was, what Israel and Saudi Arabia both fear is an end of the status quo. They fear peace. They prefer an American Cold War with Iran. An end of the Cold War with Iran could mean the beginning of the end of America serving their interests so closely, when they've been able to hop on America's hate Iran bandwagon and ride it so thoroughly for the last 40 years. That's what Israel doesn't want. They're not afraid. I got Danielle Pletka. Where are you, Danielle? I got Danielle Pletka from the AEI admitting the problem is not that Iran, if they got a nuclear weapon, might use it. We're not worried about that. We're worried about that if they got a nuclear weapon, they might not use it and prove that they're a responsible power in the region and then that people can do business with them and then the Cold War against them would be over, basically, is what she says. Let me see if I can find her. Nope. Where is it? I don't have it. Well, I'm not here, but maybe I can find it during the break. But anyway, and you know what? Read Justin, antiwar.com/Justin today about Netanyahu and the myth of the special relationship. It's a good one. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Alright, wait, I wasn't done complaining about the Iran-Israel thing. Sorry, I go too long on certain subjects. So listen, believe me, I understand and I forgive you if you don't pay any attention to the news at all because you just can't stand it, but I'll go ahead and tell you what's going on. Everybody's really freaking out about this scheme by the Prime Minister of Israel to come and give a speech to the Congress without checking with the Democrats in Congress or with the Democrats in the White House either first. And the Obama had one of his staff members tell Haaretz, the Israeli paper, that we don't take this kindly, and this is spitting in our face, and we don't like it, and there will be consequences. And man, they're really pissed off. And then, even over there on Fox News, Chris Wallace and Shep Smith, as Peter Beinart wrote in Haaretz, they get all kind of Jacksonian on us, a little bit right-wing nationalist. Hey, Israel, we love you, and we hate Iran, but don't you come and try to undermine our president. What the hell are you doing, dude? This is Fox News. This is Chris Wallace and Shepard Smith. And they kind of went on and on about it. I mean, they clearly got the memo. This is something, have you ever seen the Roger Ailes memos? At least purported ones, but I think they're legit. About, this is what we're going to talk about today, and this is the spin on it that we're going to use, and that kind of thing. You could see the memo behind this. Fox News is officially a little bit pissed off about this, and we want Wallace and Shep out there, you know, hashing this thing over a bit. And they talk about the personal insult of it. And this is the controversy. This is why it's so controversial, is the fear of pro-Zionists that, oh no, you've gone too far. And it's amazing just to see how loud these voices are when they come out in unison on a certain thing like this. The entire threat is that American supplication to the will of the Israeli government could be jeopardized in the future if you overplay your hand. Don't call the president boy. Even right-wing racist rednecks are gonna get pissed off at you, man, because he's our guy anyway. You're fine, but you're from far away across oceans from here, dude. You might as well be an Arab. Look out, say the right-wing Jacksonian Fox News watching types. And so what can compete with their completely shady Cornerstone Church style theology, right-wing nationalism, George Washington worship? And so that's what the freakout's about, and that's it's all over the place, including even Robert Kagan has a piece where he says, hey, listen, our interests in Israel's are not the same, and Israel should not be treated this way much, or shouldn't be considered this much different than any other nation, basically because that's my name, don't wear it out. Get it? That's the whole thing here. You're abusing the American. That was what the president of Israel said. Shimon Peres said, you're abusing the American political system, and you're going to anger the American people here. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu's position, we already know. If you go to my Twitter feed, you can see the video for yourself. No one's challenged the translation. They just tried to play it down. I don't speak Hebrew. Maybe you can ask a Hebrew-speaking friend to double-check the translation for you. But nobody challenged it. And it's Netanyahu believing that the video camera is off, being secretly recorded in a right-wing settler's house, and explaining to them how he screwed Bill Clinton right in the face on the Oslo Accord. And he laughs at the American people. He mocks and ridicules us, not just our politicians that we hate too. And what are you going to do, say something nice about them? Even where we do feel like, hey, you can't talk about them, they're ours to talk about. But no, he's talking about us. The Americans are easily moved. 80% of them support Israel. It's absurd. End quote. Netanyahu said, it's absurd how easy it is for me to tell them what to think and what to do. They're pathetic. And that was why on September 11th, when asked, what does this mean? He said, it's good. It'll be good for Israel. And years later, he said, we are benefiting from the attack on the Twin Towers and the American struggle in Iraq, too. Yeah, not just we're benefiting from the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, who we hated. We are benefiting from the American struggle in Iraq. What did he mean by that? Angry Arabs with AKs are America's enemy. So that makes it easier for Americans to believe that Israel is just like us and has the same enemies as us. And no wonder that they're fighting, because they're up against the same bad guys that we're up against. And this lie. And he's so blatant, the current prime minister of Israel, he is so just confident that he says these things out loud. The more the American soldiers suffer in their no-win urban war, the more the American people will be dumb enough to conflate their conflict with ours. The easier it'll be to buffalo them, to sucker them. Boy, someone ought to send a memo to Shep Smith. Hey, you feel a little bit insulted? Let you in on a couple of little things that you might have overlooked here. But when I read Robert Kagan's piece, I thought, oh no, I hope this doesn't mean that Netanyahu cancels. Because if he cancels, then all of these horrible results that these Israel lobbyists and neocons are predicting won't come true. And that's what I want. I want the politicization, which I can't even say apparently, of the Israel issue in America. This issue that's supposed to be undiscussed. This issue that's supposed to be complete consensus among all of the political class in America, that whatever Israel wants, it gets. And if they change their mind and they want something else now, they get that. And it's just fine. And if they disapprove of America's policy, then America better change their damn policy. That's how it's supposed to be. And I want to have the fight. When the last time a foreign head of state came and spoke to Congress three times, the only time any other foreign head of state had done that, it was Winston Churchill, who was the president's best friend and ally. They were working together, mostly to get Americans into the war and then to celebrate our entry into it and all that. To give that at least supposed honor to Benjamin Netanyahu so that he can come and try to sabotage a peace deal? To try to think of it when, and there were plenty of right-wingers, I guess, who opposed Kissinger and Nixon's detente with Russia and China. The opening to China and the somewhat opening to the Soviet Union as well in the 1970s. But can you imagine if the Democrats had brought in some right-wing fascist from South America to give a speech to a joint session of Congress denouncing President Nixon for his opening to China? Yeah, no, they wouldn't have done that. That would be kind of ridiculous. And of course, that's the only thing that anyone can ever say good about Nixon. You know, he did open up China, man. He ended the Cold War with China. Everything else about the guy is, all you can think of is just the corpses and the rivers of blood. He was an absolute monster. But at least he went over there and shook hands with Mao Zedong. What a great thing. Which I absolutely agree with. I hope I'm making that clear. As ironical as it kind of sounds, it's certainly better than the alternative. But anyway, Jeffrey Goldberg interviewed Ron Dermer, and Netanyahu himself has come out and defended the decision. And here Ron Dermer is telling Jeffrey Goldberg, no, hell yeah, we're going through with it. We gotta stop it, the Iranians from having a nuclear program at all. Come on. He didn't outright say that, but that's the implication. There is no breakout time that's long enough. Oh, man. Another whole segment gone on Israel and Iran. Oh, well. Coming up, a great interview with Catherine Hawkins. I'm thinking about the torture report. And then I got a ton of news, and I swear I'm going to try to keep the moralizing at a minimum. I should never say that. It's self-sabotage. But I got a ton of news to get out of the way before the weekend comes. Be right back after this.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. If you look at antiwar.com today, the spotlight is this great piece in Politico magazine, politico.com/magazine. The Lies Hidden Inside the Torture Report. It's by Catherine Hawkins. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you on the show. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to say that you are a fellow at openthegovernment.org, Americans for Less Secrecy, More Democracy.
That's correct.
Openthegovernment.org. Okay, very good. So, yeah, very important piece that you have here, and you start us right off with the point, if I have it right, you're saying that the common kind of refrain or conventional wisdom, I think, in D.C. has had it, that whatever tortures the CIA guys did, even though we might say they're against the law, at the time they were told they were covered by these memos. And so as long as they were acting within the good faith of the memos, then they're covered and sorry, we just can't prosecute them. And so they did even have that special prosecutor, Durham, who looked at obstruction of justice. And then he expanded his preliminary investigation on the obstruction of justice of the destruction of the videotapes to a couple of cases of murders in, you know, where men were tortured to death because he said, well, that's clearly outside the memo. But then he decided not to prosecute that either. And that was basically as far as any of that, any step toward any kind of prosecution ever went, as far as I understand. But now what you're telling me in this article, if I read you right, is that now that you've read the report, now it's clear that that's not true, that they were covered by these memos.
Is that
right, and why not?
That's right. A couple clarifications. I think that it has been obvious for a while that they did not limit themselves to the four corners of what was in the torture memos, and the deaths are not the only examples of cases we know of where they exceeded what the Department of Justice said they could do. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's not just that they went beyond what the memo said. It's that a lot of the memo's conclusions are based on the CIA telling the Department of Justice of a series of facts about how the techniques would be used, about how often, under what circumstances, about the CIA's position was, we're going to inflict just enough pain, just long enough to get life-saving intelligence. We're not going to break these guys. If we do, they're not going to stay broken. And we've saved hundreds of thousands of lives using these techniques. You find those in a memo that John Yoo signed in 2002, not the death or organ failure memo. There are two memos he sent at the same time. And this was the one to the CIA that the CIA has said is the one it relied on, where he went technique by technique and said, this one's okay, this one's okay, this one's okay. Then later on, there are five major torture memos by OLC, by Stephen Bradbury at OLC. And there are a number of letters and smaller memos as well. And with the exception of the one original John Yoo memo that was suspended that says, well, it's unconstitutional to outlaw torture anyway, the memos say it's not torture because of X, and it's a factual claim that the CIA made. Mm-hmm. And those claims are false.
So, in other words, that's the disclaimer on the legal memos, the cover memos, is if you do it exactly like you're telling me you're doing it, then that's okay.
Right.
And now we're not talking about morally or even legally under the real law, but just under the narrow confines of the way that they set this up.
Right.
And you're saying because the CIA wasn't being truthful with John Yoo about what they were doing with these people, the memos are moot right there.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about why DOJ never prosecuted anyone. And unfortunately, like a lot of information still, even now after the Senate report comes out about the torture program itself, that we don't know why DOJ never prosecuted anyone. When the Senate report came out, people asked DOJ, is there new information here? Are you going to reopen the investigations in light of this information? DOJ said, no, we looked at the report. There's nothing new. We knew all this. And then just a week or so ago, the Department of Justice filed a declaration in a Freedom of Information Act case saying, no, we never read the report, at least not the full report, not the 7,000-page version that is still classified. That's locked away in an envelope that no one has ever opened, and the FBI hasn't even picked up its copy. At the same time, they're saying that John Durham looked at all the possible evidence as independently as possible, and there was just no way to make a case. The admissible evidence would not prove conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, but we don't know why. There's an assumption that it's the torture memos that may still be part of it. One of the memos that says the torture statute is unconstitutional, that's the only one that doesn't depend on all these factual claims, but that does exist. Even though it was a ridiculous argument but we don't know whether it was reliance on the memos. We don't know.
Well, and even the Bush administration rescinded that memo, right?
Right, exactly. We don't know. And in Iraq, the John Rizzo, the Office of the General Counsel, lawyer at the CIA, I interviewed him when I was the investigator for an NGO report on torture for the Constitution Project's Task Force on Detainee Treatment. He said the CIA wasn't supposed to be holding prisoners in Iraq. And there's a CIA detainee in Iraq who is killed. And no one is ever prosecuted for that death, for the death in Afghanistan that the Senate report discusses. There's case after case where the memo didn't apply, the memo's factual representations are untrue. And then there's, even leaving aside acts of torture, there's acts of destruction of evidence, lying to Congress. And, DOJ refrain is no admissible evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, and they won't say anything more about it. My suspicion is that it's because the CIA can classify all the evidence, and that's why the evidence is inadmissible. But DOJ simply won't comment on why the investigations were closed.
Well, isn't the real answer politics? Because the people who are guilty are all too powerful, elected and appointed officials. To have them prosecuted would be to turn the world upside down.
That is certainly a possibility. I think that can't be DOJ's stated justification.
Oh, right. They got to come up with something. Yeah.
Right. I think
sworn to faithfully execute the law, right?
Not to ignore
and pick and choose which felonies get prosecuted.
Right. I mean, in the ACLU case, no, I'm sorry, not the ACLU case. The very smart New York Times reporter, Charlie Savage, filed a Freedom of Information Act case looking for information about the DOJ investigations and all kinds of information, notes from the FBI interviews called 302s, which are often released in FOIA cases, and the memos from Durham explaining why he didn't prosecute. But the DOJ says the public just doesn't have a right to know any of this. And
is it presumed, Catherine, that Durham had access to everything that Feinstein's committee ended up having access to? Because when we read that the DOJ has their full classified version of the report sitting in a safe somewhere and they're not even looking at it, I mean, that just sounds crazy. Are they claiming we already know everything in there?
That was the claim they made, and obviously that they cannot, you know, DOJ lawyers don't have X-ray vision if they haven't opened or read the report. They haven't opened or read the report.
Yeah, let's get that Panetta report, and then we'll see. But
yeah.
I'm sorry. I asked you a question right up against the break. We got to take this break. We'll be right back with Catherine Hawkins. She wrote this great piece for Politico magazine, "The Lies Hidden Inside the Torture Report." Back in a minute.
Hey, Al Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make the show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Catherine Hawkins. She is the National Security Fellow at OpenTheGovernment.org and previously was an investigator for the Constitution Project's Task Force on Detainee Treatment. And she's got this great piece, this very important piece, at Politico Magazine, "The Lies Hidden Inside the Torture Report." It's the spotlight today. On antiwar.com, you can find it right there. And now, I'm sorry, Catherine, when we were so rudely interrupted by the hard break there, you were, I believe, going to continue your answer about my question of whether at least they're claiming that Durham had access to everything that the Senate Intelligence Committee had access to, and that's why they don't need, or are they even invoking an excuse for not looking at the full report in their safe?
I don't think anyone's gotten that far with them about exactly what they're claiming. I mean, Durham had access to a lot of information, but I don't know if it was everything that the Senate had or not. And, I mean, for instance, the Panetta review, I don't know if he had access to that. But beyond that, some of the original documents, I just don't know. Mm-hmm. Durham filed a declaration in the Freedom of Information Act case about the files from his investigation and said that it's basically Durham saying, I was really, really, really independent and thorough, extraordinarily independent and thorough, but, you know, there's no details. It says, well, it was so important, so the public had to have confidence in the result, but if they want the public to have confidence in the result, they have to explain it, give some information, and they haven't done that.
Well, and anyone who just looks at the report, even through the redactions, can see that it's just a list of felonies.
Yes.
That's all it is. If any of us did any of these things to anybody, these exact same people would be the ones locking us in a cage for the rest of our lives.
I mean, even beyond the what was done to detainees, we knew the torture tapes were destroyed. What the report reveals is that they were actually destroyed in response to a proposal for a congressional investigation. That was the immediate impetus for the drive to destroy the copies. There is a very damning list of statements that CIA Director Michael Hayden made to Congress, which was just full of inaccurate statements. And with a lot of it, you think, it's beyond the point where you can think he misspoke. I mean, in the 70s, a CIA director was prosecuted for making inaccurate statements to Congress. And then there are the acts of what was done to detainees. And one of the things the report reveals is that opposition to prosecutions is often presented as, let's protect the field agents. They were just following orders, following what the Department of Justice said was legal. There are many instances in the report where the field agents say, we think this guy is broken. And headquarters says, no, keep going, keep going, keep going. It happened in the Abu Zubaydah interrogation. It happened in the Abdel Rahim al-Nashiri investigation. We knew from a CIA Inspector General's report that a CIA agent had threatened Nashiri with a power drill and a handgun. And we learn in the report that headquarters sent him, and the defense of the person who ran the site was, well, you sent him. I thought he could do whatever he wanted. So I think the argument that they're just protecting the field agents, it's often the people within the leadership of the Counterterrorism Center who are being protected.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, if we were talking about private actors here, what you do is you go ahead and indict the lower down guys and then make deals. If they all want to rat on Condoleezza Rice, then that's just fine. And we'll, you know, take time off of their sentence, depending on how many years she gets. That's pretty easy. Just as one example, obviously George Tenet and Dick Cheney and George Bush himself and all their lawyers who conspired to do this.
Yeah, and even when the Constitution Project report came out, and I no longer work for the Constitution Project or speak for them, but what we said about prosecutions was, look, you know, there is no evidence of the sort. You know, we weren't John Durham. We didn't have – we were relying entirely on open sources. We had no basis for saying this person should have been prosecuted, that person should have been prosecuted. But the Convention Against Torture says that there has to be independent investigation and prosecution for these acts, and that just – you can't look at the record, look at what happened, and look at the results in accountability and claim that the U.S. is in compliance with that. I mean, it's just – it sort of speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's even a part in there that you quote from the report where they're quoting from – I believe it's, is it an agent in the field is saying, hey, listen, I need a better cover letter from you guys over these things that you're asking me to do, because otherwise, and then he cites by name, I'd be in violation of the torture statute. So I want one more pass before I continue. Do I have that?
Yeah,
right there?
I think that, so there was a letter from, there was, in the provision of inaccurate information to the Department of Justice, the lawyers, there are some lawyers in the CIA Counterterrorism Center, who are sort of the John Hughes of the CIA, and their names are actually redacted from the report, although they are not classified and have been identified publicly in the past. There's a lawyer named Jonathan Fredman and a lawyer named Robert Ettinger, who each of whom held the position of being the chief counsel for the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. And they were really key figures because they were very often the go-betweens between the CIA and the Office of Legal Counsel, providing the information about the program. And I think it was one of those lawyers, if it was earlier in the program, it would have logically been Fredman, who said it would be a violation of the torture statute, so let's use the necessity defense and decline in advance to prosecute. And the CIA's, I'm sorry, the Department of Justice's criminal division said, we don't do that. You don't decline to prosecute in advance. And instead, there was the memo from John Yoo saying that
Chertoff that said no there, right? That pushed back?
Yeah, it was Chertoff who said
that's
no.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, don't worry, we'll just get John Yoo to give us the permission slip instead.
I mean, exactly. There's discussion of exactly how the torture memo came to be drafted. The first set of torture memos came to be drafted in the in a report by the Office of Professional Responsibility. So there's less of that in the Senate report. But, very, very soon after, right after DOJ says, no, we are not going to do this advanced declination, then you get these memos instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the other Scott Horton, the heroic lawyer and author and journalist, he says he compares all these lawyers to mob lawyers who the DOJ prosecutes all the time. If they can spin it that these lawyers are actually conspiring with their mob clients to help them get around the law, that you're no longer a lawyer representing your client, you're now a criminal too, and you go to jail. And when you read the ridiculousness of so many of these memos about Bush's authority to deny any other jurisdiction's review and all the rest of this stuff, sure makes it seem like they got a great case against the lawyers, if not the principals, that, you know, at least to start here, if they wanted to.
Well, put it this way. There, one thing that I think, even beyond the question of criminal liability, is the question of violations of professional ethics. The Department of Justice did an investigation like that. It ended up that no one was held accountable. For the lawyers at CIA and for the doctors in the Office of Medical Services and the CIA contractors like James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who had such a major role in the program, there hasn't been even that, even a report that a DOJ official overrode. We haven't even gotten to figuring out. Mm-hmm. We haven't even gotten that far.
All right. Well, with that, we'll let it go. I'm sorry I actually kept you a little bit over time here, but thank you very much for your time, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
All right, y'all. That's Catherine Hawkins. She wrote this great piece, The Lies Hidden Inside the Torture Report. Why these memos are moot. Put them all in the dock. That's what I say. Catherine Hawkins. She's the National Security Fellow at OpenTheGovernment.org and previously was the investigator for the Constitution Project's Task Force on Detainee Treatment. Again, it's politico.com/magazine. We'll be right back in a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Ah, hell, I blew that break. Sorry, guys. I know I always do that, but sometimes my show just don't conform to the breaks. It is what it is. It ain't gonna change. It's been like this. It's gonna stay this way. All right. So the Libya story, man. Did I tell you guys about this Libya story? Washington Times. Hillary Clinton undercut on Libya war by the Pentagon. Rewind, 2011. A guy sets himself on fire because the local bureaucrats seized or wouldn't let him operate his vegetable cart in Tunisia. Riots ensued. The American sock puppet dictator Ben Ali fled. And the people in Egypt all turned and said, "You can do that?" And then they proceeded to overthrow the American sock puppet dictator, fascist military torturer, murderer, Hosni Mubarak from power. Then Hillary realized she had a PR problem. Bad. Everyone knows that Uncle Sam backs not democracy, but dictatorship in the Middle East. Not that the victims didn't realize, but the American people were seeing, come on, when it's the dictator versus all the Egyptians in the street demanding his ouster, the American people are on the side of the people. And they don't dress in crazy Arab clothes or whatever in Egypt, right? They dress in normal Western clothes like we're used to, easier for people to identify with them than somebody in robes or something, right? They didn't wear funny hats. They wear jeans and shirts. So the American people, even American TV, on the side of the people. So they had a PR problem, so they decided to stab their new friend, Muammar Gaddafi, in the back as expendable and wage a war for the uprising against him, which of course included a bunch of al-Qaeda guys who are veterans of the war that she supported, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where they had just spent years fighting against the Americans and the Shiite militias that the Americans were backing there. Wow, and they've updated this article now to say first of three parts. Oh, good. Because this is a good one. They don't mean page 1 of 3. I'm on the printer version here. Top Pentagon officials and a senior Democrat in Congress so distrusted Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's 2011 march to war in Libya that they opened their own diplomatic channels with the Gaddafi regime in an effort to halt the escalating crisis, according to secret audio recordings recovered from Tripoli. The tapes, reviewed by the Washington Times and authenticated by the participants, chronicle U.S. officials' unfiltered conversations with Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's son and a top Libyan leader, including criticisms that Mrs. Clinton had developed tunnel vision and led the U.S. into an unnecessary war without adequately weighing the intelligence community's concerns. Quote, "You should see these internal State Department reports that are produced in the State Department that go out to Congress. They're just full of stupid, stupid facts," end quote, an American intermediary specifically dispatched by the Joint Chiefs of Staff told the Gaddafi regime in July 2011. So that's not the Pentagon's role, right? But here they are trying to undermine a march to war. saying the State Department was controlling what intelligence would be reported to U.S. officials. At the time, the Gaddafi regime was fighting a civil war that grew out of the Arab Spring, battling Islamist-backed rebels who wanted to dethrone the longtime dictator. Mrs. Clinton argued that Gaddafi might engage in genocide and create a humanitarian crisis, and ultimately persuaded President Obama, NATO allies, and the UN to authorize military intervention. Gaddafi's son and heir apparent, Saif Gaddafi, told American officials in the secret conversation that he was worried Mrs. Clinton was using false pretenses to justify unseating his father, and insisted that the regime had no intention of harming a mass of civilians. He compared Mrs. Clinton's campaign for war to that of the George W. Bush administration's now debunked weapons of mass destruction accusations, which were used to lobby Congress to invade Iraq, the tapes show. Quote, "It was like the WMD in Iraq. It was based on a false report," Gaddafi said in a May 2011 phone call to Representative Dennis J. Kucinich, an Ohio Democrat serving at the time. Round of applause. Libyan airplanes bombing demonstrators, Libyan airplanes bombing districts in Tripoli, Libyan army killed thousands, etc., etc. And now the whole world found there's no single evidence that such things happened in Libya. Saif Gaddafi also warned that many of the U.S.-supported armed rebels were not freedom fighters, but rather jihadists, whom he described as gangsters and terrorists. Quote, "And now you have NATO supporting them with ships, with airplanes, helicopters, arms, training, communication," he said in one recorded conversation with U.S. officials. "We ask the American government send a fact-finding mission to Libya. I want you to see everything with your own eyes." The surreptitiously taped conversations reveal an extraordinary departure from traditional policy in which the U.S. government speaks to foreign governments with one voice coordinated by the State Department. Instead, the tapes show that the Pentagon's senior uniformed leadership and a congressman from Mrs. Clinton's own party conveyed sentiments to the Libyan regime that undercut or conflicted with the Secretary of State's own message at the time. Quote, check this out. "If this story is true, it would be highly unusual for the Pentagon to conduct a separate set of diplomatic negotiations, given the way we operated when I was Secretary of State," said James A. Baker III, Sith Lord, who served under President George H.W. Bush. "In our administration, the president made sure we all sang from the same hymnal." Yeah. Mr. Kucinich, who challenged Mrs. Clinton and Barack Obama for the nomination, acknowledged that he undertook his own conversations with the Gaddafi regime. He said he feared Mrs. Clinton was using emotion to sell a war against Libya that wasn't warranted, and he wanted to get all the information he could to share with his congressional colleagues. "I had facts," he said, "that indicated America was heading once again into an intervention that was going to be disastrous," Mr. Kucinich told the Times. "What was being said at the State Department, if you look at the charge at the time, it wasn't so much about what happened as it was about what would happen. So there was a distortion of events that were occurring in Libya to justify an intervention which was essentially wrong and illegal." Mr. Kucinich wrote a letter to Mr. Obama and Mrs. Clinton in August explaining his communications in a last-ditch effort to stop the war. "I've been contacted by an intermediary in Libya who has indicated that President Muammar Gaddafi is willing to negotiate an end to the conflict under conditions which would seem to favor administration policy," Mr. Kucinich wrote on August the 24th. Again, 2011. "Neither the White House nor the State Department responded to his letter," he said. A spokesman for Mrs. Clinton declined to provide any comment about the recordings. The State Department also declined to answer questions about separate contacts from the Pentagon and Mr. Kucinich with the Gaddafi regime, but said the goal of Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Obama was regime change in Libya. Quote, "U.S. policy during the revolution supported regime change through peaceful means, in line with UNSCR, that's Security Council Resolution 1973 policy and NATO mission goals," the State Department says. "We consistently emphasized at the time that Muammar Gaddafi had to step down and leave Libya as an essential component of the transition." Both inside and outside the Obama administration, continues the Washington Times here is what I'm reading, Mrs. Clinton was among the most vocal early proponents of using U.S. military force to unseat Gaddafi. joining her in making the case were French President Nicolas Sarkozy, Senator John McCain, Arizona Republican, and her successor as Secretary of State, John F. Kerry. Mrs. Clinton's main argument was that Gaddafi was about to engage in genocide against civilians in Benghazi, where the rebels held their center of power. But defense intellectuals... Defense intelligence officials could not corroborate those concerns and, in fact, assessed that Gaddafi was unlikely to risk world outrage by inflicting mass casualties, officials told the Times. As a result, Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates and Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, strongly opposed Mrs. Clinton's recommendation to use force. That's where we got to leave it. We'll be back with most of the rest of this after this break. Very important story in the Washington Times.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And I'm going through this this Libya story. More troops going to Iraq. I think Daily Beast and Wall Street Journal... pretty much confirming what we already knew from Roy Gutman, that the CIA was cutting the FSA loose and switching back to Assad there. I'm pretty much with it. Human Rights Watch has a story today saying, hey, it's the war on terror that's creating all the terror. It's destabilizing the whole region, radicalizing a generation, leading to a lot of bloodletting and a lot of country destruction. Yeah, you're right about that, Kenneth Roth. In Afghanistan, they're basically classifying the entire mission. They don't want anybody asking any questions about what's going on in Afghanistan from now on. There's a good story about that on antiwar.com today as well. And also there's, still green on blue insider attacks. Afghan army killed a couple of Americans at the airport, yesterday. I think it was maybe day before that. Obama's asking for the biggest military budget ever, and he already had the record. Eat your heart out, Ronald Reagan. Yes, adjusted for inflation, and there's been a lot of inflation. More than any time, greater amount than any time since World War II. And then, it was a world war. And then, I had a bunch of police state and torture news. I just won't be able to get to you. Oh, and they were going to spend $400 billion on the care and feeding of all the hydrogen bombs, too. $400 billion on the upkeep of the H-bombs that could be used to kill all people on the planet. Bombs that can kill entire major cities in one shot. Bombs that disrupt the food chain that keeps us all living. In a way that makes many of us die. There's no reason for human beings to allow their politicians to own these damn things. It's crazy. You see a story like that? $400 billion for H-bombs? When our conventional military can erase any capital city on this planet that dared use nukes on us without nukes. We just don't need them. Our military, all things being equal, can deter any attack by any nation state on this planet without nukes. The fact that we lead tied with the Russians for holding still thousands of them, 7,000 American nukes, operational nuclear weapons, absolutely out of control. the most important issue in the whole world. And then we let our government pick a fight with the Russians, a Cold War, and a border dispute in Ukraine, 7 million miles east of here. God dang. All right, anyway, back to the Libya story. So Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, when we last left the Washington Times story, Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, the Republican, the guy who didn't see the fall of the Soviet Union coming, George W. Bush's surge implementer in the Iraq War, Obama's in Afghanistan, told Obama, don't do it. Don't attack Libya. That's all you need, Obama, to not start a war, is to say, listen, my Secretary of Defense, oh, and Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're both telling me, more harm than good. Al-Qaeda and Iraq veterans are the ones trying to overthrow him. They're the ones you'd be helping. Are you extra sure about this? All the cover he needed to not do it. What did Obama do? He told Gates, be quiet. I'm listening to Hillary Clinton say things. Barack Obama. Somebody's shareholders must have got to him. Listen, we want to get rid of some bomb inventories and replenish them, and you're going to do this, okay? Something. Maybe the Israelis called. Gaddafi was certainly always on Ariel Sharon's list. And of course, as Eric Margolies explained, the Saudis always hated Gaddafi. He was always making fun of them for wearing dresses and stuff and outside of their folds, so nice little confluence of interest there. They say the gold dinar for the oil. I don't know everything about that. That may have played into it, too. But he was not trying to pick a fight with America. I don't believe that if the gold dinar thing was that big of a deal, I don't think he would have done it. He had been begging to come back in from the cold for 10 years. Well, 7 years. And then was stabbed in the back. 8 years after that or something. Anyway, damn it. Yeah. Anyway, so Gates says, don't do it. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, don't do it. Obama goes with Rice and Power and Clinton. Numerous U.S. officials interviewed by the Washington Times confirm that Mrs. Clinton and not Mr. Obama led the charge to use NATO military force to unseat Gaddafi as Libya's leader, and that she repeatedly dismissed the warnings offered by career military and intelligence officials. In the recovered recordings, a U.S. intelligence liaison working for the Pentagon told a Gaddafi aide that Mr. Obama privately informed members of Congress that Libya, quote, is all Secretary Clinton's matter, and that the nation's highest-ranking generals were concerned that the president was being misinformed. The Pentagon liaison indicated on the tapes that Army General Charles H. Jacoby Jr., a top aide to Admiral Mullen, quote, does not trust the reports that are coming out of the State Department and CIA, but there's nothing he can do about it. In one conversation to the Libyans, the American intelligence asset said, quote, I can tell you that the president is not getting accurate information. So at some point, someone has to get accurate information to him. I think about a way through former Secretary Gates, or maybe Admiral Mullen, to get him information. I guess maybe Gates resigned in the middle and was replaced by Panetta in the middle of the war. Is that it? I forget now. That must be it. The recordings are consistent with what many high-ranking intelligence, military, and academic sources told the Times. Mrs. Clinton was headstrong to enter the Libyan crisis, ignoring the Pentagon's warnings that no U.S. interests were at stake and regional stability could be threatened. Instead, she relied heavily on the assurance of the Libyan rebels and her own memory of Rwanda, where U.S. inaction may have led to the genocide of at least 500,000 people. I've seen that challenged quite a bit, too, so I'm going to take that for granted, but I don't know. Neither the intervention decision nor the regime change decision was an intelligence-heavy decision, said one senior intelligence official directly involved with the administration's decision-making, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. People weren't on the edge of their seats. Intelligence wasn't driving the decision one way or the other. instead of relying on the Defense Department or the intelligence community for analysis, officials told the Times, the White House trusted Mrs. Clinton's charge, which was then supported by Ambassador to the UN Rice and National Security Council member Samantha Power, as reason enough for war. Susan Rice was involved in the Rwanda crisis in 94. Samantha Power wrote a very moving book about what happened there, and Hillary Clinton was also in the background of that crisis as well, said Alan Lynch, a professor of international relations. I think they've all carried this kind of with them. Well, it was their excuse anyway. In 2003, Gaddafi agreed to dismantle his weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't have any, and denounce terrorism to reestablish relations with the West. He later made reparations to the families of those who died in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, even though he very likely didn't do it. But anyway, that I added that part. News media frequently described the apparent transformation as Libya coming in from the cold. Still, he ruled Benghazi, iron grip, and was a jerk. Loyalist forces mobilized tanks and troops toward Benghazi, creating a panicked mass exodus of civilians towards Egypt. Clinton met with Libyan rebel spokesman Mahmoud Jibril in the Paris Westin Hotel in mid-March so she could vet the rebel cause to unseat Gaddafi. 45 minutes after speaking with Mr. Jibril, Mrs. Clinton was convinced that a military intervention was needed. Quote, I talked extensively about the dreams of a democratic civil state where all Libyans are equal and and everything is great, Jibril told the Times. By the end of the meeting, I passed the test. Benghazi was saved. Sorry, I had to spare us both that entire paragraph. So on March 17, 2011, the U.S. supported U.N. Security Council Resolution 1973, which was just a no-fly zone, but as I told you at the time, if you give them a no-fly zone, then you're accepting their premise that the people of the East are not safe as long as Gaddafi's in power. And once you accept that premise, it's only one step. It ain't calculus. It's simple arithmetic. It's one step to say, well, we've got to get rid of Gaddafi then. And that's exactly what it was. But then, oh, crap, I'm out of time, and I never did get to the great quote. It's in here. I swear it's in here where they talk about how it was all for public relations, how Hillary wanted it to look in light of the Arab Spring. Anyway, read this thing. It's at the Washington Times. I know it sounds unlikely, but it's good, and it's there. See you Sunday morning on KPFK. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.